Happily Divorced, or How to Rob the Robber, by Ben Floor. Narrated by Adam Naranjo. Los Angeles. Life is like a heavy shower. You can't hide and get wet all over. I endured 64 years in the rain, and just 15 minutes ago I got struck by lightning. Here I stand outside the courtroom. My divorce is now official. I have no wife, no house, nor any money. She bought the whole world for herself and left me completely broke. I don't think I can start a new career as a baseball player, waiter, or even a dishwasher at my age with my worn knees. In such a state of total disaster, you don't want to meet stupid, noisy people like George. Yet he bumped into me as he tried to leave the damn building at the same time, through the same door. Men in their 60s who look as happy as George does can't be trusted. You can't fool life by laughing it away. Still, he apologized, wrapped his arm around my shoulder, and offered me a drink. "You look awful," was the first thing that he said, and he didn't stop talking about his personal life. Even before we crossed the street to the little pub at the opposite side of the road, I already knew that he, too, was just divorced. For 40 long years, he was married to a wife as grumpy as me, he said. I heard he was broke as well. However, in his case, it was he who had spent all the money instead of his wife. "Money," he said, "was my way out, but now my wife has left and I'm broke. I feel free like I'm 18 again." George had a nice and healthy skin without any deep wrinkles like me. He kindly bought me 3 or 4 beers, but when it was time to pay, he didn't have any money. He relied on me, but I had less than $1 on me. Fortunately, he managed to borrow $25 from a total stranger. George promised to give it back. The man gave him his card. This is where and when my life started to change. I'll give you a resume. That same Friday, I tried to rent a cheap flat on the 4th floor in a busy shopping street. The flat had 4 bedrooms and a balcony. Its condition was horrible and far too expensive for its size. But as I left, George entered, also in search of an affordable place to sleep. He took the business card of the man he became friends with out of his pocket, and we decided to rent the flat with 3 men and advertise for number 4. It was not a nice neighborhood we moved into. We even heard that on the 5th floor right above us, a strong and tattooed neighbor, who hardly ever was at home, used his apartment to grow cannabis plants. We decided not to betray the man for our own sake. During the following week, I learned that our 3rd roommate was a 62-year-old homosexual, but by this time I had already signed the rental agreement, so I could not withdraw. When I write the complete version of this book, I'll tell you how it is for a serious person like me to live with a show-off like George and an old drama queen like Michael, sharing the same living room, kitchen, and bathroom. You can imagine, I like to listen to classical music. George is fond of tearjerkers, and Michael cries every time he listens to songs of the 60s. Altogether, I am the only one who is serious about politics, religion, the environment, and what I eat and drink. I am not a smoker, nor a heavy drinker. George, on the other hand, is. Every evening we listened to his stories, whether we liked it or not, how he got rich by selling insurance and toothbrushes. He kept bragging about all the great meals he ate, the cars he possessed, and the fact that he had played golf. Michael believed him. George's health is just as bad as mine, which is easy to understand for a man over 65 years, but he never let on. I discovered that he goes to the toilet 3 times at night because of his prostate problems, but he never mentioned it. He also had a stroke and a bypass operation, but he only talked about my worn knees. Once I made the mistake telling him about the fact that I fainted at the railway station whilst I was waiting for my train. I did not eat very much that day, but George kept reminding me of all kinds of other complications. Michael, on the other hand, is definitely the healthiest of us 3. He jogs 5 times a week in Bloomsdale Park in an orange training suit that most probably was too tight even way back in his 40s. All the muscles around his shoulders moved to his stomach. Even George didn't have the guts to tell him that he would never find a new friend as long as he wears that old-fashioned outfit. We differ very much, but we do have one serious wish in common. Every day we bring travel brochures home and dream of an everlasting holiday in the sun. That would be better for my knees. George believes he will stop smoking there, and Michael is convinced that a fine young native will be waiting for him on the beach. These holiday brochures are free, and the fact is that none of us have enough money for a day tour by bus. It would take us 25 years to save for a trip to the Caribbean islands, and that's without a return ticket. The only things I possess of my former marriage are some clothes, a cat I carved out of wood, which my wife detested, and a pair of binoculars, the only thing I ever bought for myself. I have to hide these binoculars from George, but he finds them anyways and uses them on the balcony where he can sit for hours watching people pass by with their shopping. Last week, Friday morning, he called Michael and me to the balcony and pointed out a man across the street. The man carried a big suitcase with him. Empty, George knew for sure. You can see it, weighs nothing. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, George called us again to the balcony. Once more, we saw the man, only this time walking in the opposite direction. He pulled the same suitcases, heavily filled with small wheels behind him. Then George pointed out another bald-headed man in a raincoat straight underneath our balcony. The man moved when the suitcase passed by. He crossed the street and followed him around the corner to Bloomsdale Park. George watched them through my binoculars, which he had found underneath my bed. When the men went around the corner, he laid my beloved possession on the railing of the balcony. I saved it from falling down, got angry, and wanted to go back inside. However, at the same moment, my attention was drawn by George's intriguing voice. What you just saw happens every Friday, same time, same place, same men. I wonder what's in that suitcase. George infected Michael and me with his suitcase virus. The following week, we took our places on the balcony and philosophized afterward about the contents of the suitcase. We fantasized during dinner time, and George interrupted my TV opera that evening 6 or more times with new ideas. In the end, Michael proposed to follow the man with the empty suitcase next Friday to find out what he picks up between 10 and 16 o'clock. I agreed just to end the discussion and continue listening to Pavarotti in Aida. 1 week later, we went downstairs, stepped outside in the drizzling rain, crossed the street, and followed the man with the suitcase. He wore a raincoat and a black hat against the rain. George and Michael shared the only umbrella we had. I resisted the rain, stood 10 meters behind him as I refused to be seen under the same umbrella with a homosexual. One never knows. Only 4 blocks away, the man stopped at a small restaurant where businessmen have their breakfast on their way to work. To avoid suspicion, only George went after him. Michael and I stayed outside on the street. After half an hour, George came out excited, catching his breath. He fell around Michael's neck, stammering. Money. He receives a bunch of paper money from the owner of the restaurant and puts it in the suitcase. We followed the man to several pubs, fashion boutiques, and even a hairdresser to find out that he collects money all the time. We were busy until 3 o'clock in the afternoon when the suitcase man went to his last address. Gracie's Bull, a pub just around the corner of our shopping street. There he met his friends, and this was the only place where he didn't ask for money. He waited and left exactly 4:05, walking back into our street, past our flat, at the opposite exactly as George had predicted. The bald-headed man from underneath our balcony crossed the street, followed the man around the corner where they went to Bloomsdale Park, as we expected. I didn't know whether it was because of the drinks we had in every pub, but I enjoyed the evening, and I also started to see my roommates as friends. From that day on, I even got less grumpy, George told me later. That evening, George convinced us that it was pure mafia money the man collected, paid for protection. And, with the new holiday brochures on the table, he added one specific sentence. I never stole any money, but I wouldn't hesitate to steal from mafia people. I'm in, Michael answered without any hesitation. I said I would rather die being honest, but George emphasized that with some money to spend, I'd just as well live in the Caribbean where my knees wouldn't hurt. Then I asked if I could take a lady friend with me. George and Michael stared at me with wide open eyes, but both agreed on one condition, that they too were allowed to invite someone. My brain refused, but my mouth said yes, so we decided to rob the robber. When you're getting on in years, you do not want to spend money on TVs, mobile phones, or internet like young people do. You get a library card instead. So it was the library where I started to visit dating sites. I found my perfect match in a serious, God-loving woman who was divorced from smoking, drinking, and spoiling wasteful good for nothing. 2 days after we planned our robbery, I promised my newfound love that I would take her to our sunny island, where we would listen to operas for the rest of our lives. George worked out the robbery plan, but one aspect gave him insuperable problems. And there was another setback. Something happened. The following Friday, we sat on the balcony, when the stupid, highly strung George couldn't sit still and pushed my binoculars off the railing. They fell 4 floors straight. It fell 4 floors down, straight on the shiny, bold head of the watchman underneath. Michael used his trained skills to run down the stairs and to come back with the binoculars. They were still intact, which they wouldn't have been if the man in the raincoat hadn't stopped its fall. However, the consequence was that the man still lay flat on the street when the police arrived 5 minutes later. An ambulance arrived as well. Saturday morning, 1 day later, the newspaper wrote about a brutal assault in one of the busiest shopping streets. A well-known criminal was hit on his head with a heavy object at clear daylight, probably by a competing gang. The man was dead. No one but us noticed that it only took 1 week for the organization to deal with the situation. The following Friday, a substitute stood underneath our balcony, just as bald as his predecessor, and in a similar raincoat. The death of the watchman helped George to complete his final idea. That Saturday, he took us to a garden center, where we bought a heavy flower pot. I don't know where he got it from, but on Sunday, George planted some grown-up cannabis plants on it. We practiced the whole week with a tennis ball in different positions of the watchman, in combination with the spot of our new flower pot on the balcony railing. We also followed the man with the suitcase to Bloomsdale Park to find the best spot to rob him. My part was to carve a pistol out of a piece of wood. Friday, the 27th of September, was D-Day. By that time, we needed the money desperately. George confessed that he was dating an attractive but very expensive woman. He had adopted my initiative and promised the lady to come along to the Caribbean. George was so convinced of our success that he already had ordered the airplane tickets for next Monday, the 30th. "One should not doubt rigorous steps like this," he proclaimed. So this is what we did that Friday, the 27th. At exactly 1 minute from 4 o'clock, Michael pushed the flower pot over the edge, and George and I watched from the other side of the street. The pot hit the watchman just as we had planned. His fall was our sign to follow the man with the money. Our money. Unwary, the suitcase man strolled around the corner into the park with us hot on his heels. Near the fountain, we robbed him. George put his hand on his shoulder, and I pushed my wooden pistol between his shoulder blades. "No step further," George said. The man stopped immediately. As planned, we led him to the bench 5 meters ahead where George told him to sit down. All the time, I stood behind the man so that he couldn't see me. George grabbed the suitcase, but the man's arm moved as well. I heard him laughing, so I strengthened the pressure of my pistol between his blades. George glanced at me over his shoulder, and I too saw the iron chain between the wrists of the man and the grip of the suitcase. George almost panicked. "In his pocket," I bluffed, with all my experience in crime. While I nodded to the side, I felt the reflex of the man trying to protect his belongings. George's hand went into the wide pocket of the raincoat and pulled out a little key. He unlocked the suitcase, and I gestured that I wanted the key. George didn't ask why. I saw he was delighted when I clicked the lock of the chain to the back of the bench. Then George ran off with the suitcase. I pushed harder with the pistol, and as planned, I disappeared as soon as George was around the corner, out of sight. A quarter of an hour later, we passed the ambulance that had come for the man underneath our balcony, and like children, we peed our pants when we reached our apartment. We decided to hide the suitcase until the ambulance had gone. The police had already spoken with Michael, who confirmed that the flower pot that had hit the unfortunate victim probably came from the 5th floor, where indeed someone lives who grows plants. 1 nervy hour later, we opened the suitcase. The result was astonishing and took our breath away. I never heard George curse as much as I did that very moment. Michael did the same before he started dancing, screaming, and crying all at the same time. I looked into the suitcase. The only thing I saw was worthless newspapers and old magazines. The Caribbeans are nice and sunny, which you did not easily forget once you've dreamed about it. It felt like we had been ripped off. Our money and our dreams had vanished. Even worse, these criminals had stolen the rest of our lives. Perhaps not more than 5 years for me, but certainly more than 20 for a young and healthy man like Michael. I was growing fond of that homosexual. I also realized that my point of view had changed even more. I discovered that there are days in a man's life that the sun could shine, and that I even liked George's lessons. I was not going to let the Caribbean islands be taken away from me. There was a certain lady I had made a promise to. So, I ran to the kitchen, took a glass of water and threw it in George's face to stop his shivering and to get him out of shock. It took me half an hour to explain and another half hour to convince my brothers in crime what the solution to our problem was. The suitcase with the money can only be in one place, I told them. They must make the switch in the last pub. They meet their friends and where they don't have to pay protection money. George was a total wreck, but Michael recovered slowly. Now it was time for Mike and me to take over the command. We had reached the conclusion that we had more right to steal the suitcase than these so-called pub friends, so we decided that Michael would infiltrate and, if possible, lock himself in. By the time the Grazy Bowl would close, he could open the door from the inside. We divided the little money we possessed as good as possible to enable Michael to buy his own drinks at the Grazy Bowl until late in the evening. I took just enough for George and me as we went to the Goat, a pub just across the street. From there, we could see everybody leaving the bowl, and at the same time, follow the man with the suitcase should he leave early in the evening. However, our plans went a different way. We were waiting at the bowl's door at 4 o'clock in the morning, with all the streetlights turned off. George had recovered quite a lot, but forgot to take the lead. So, by the time Michael showed up and opened the door, George followed me inside like a puppy after his master. Michael had played his role as a pub visitor well and was drunk. But even so, he could get us in anyway, and I found the suitcase behind the bar. We left. I dragged the heavy suitcase behind me, and George and Michael followed, singing dirty songs and hanging over each other's shoulder. In that state of well-being, we arrived at our flat. George and Michael had not fully forgotten our mission, so we opened the suitcase together. This time, it was loaded with money. I couldn't fall asleep, so the rest of the night, I was condemned to listen to the peaceful snorings of my two roommates. I admit, these two changed my life. I learned that homosexuals are normal people like you and me, and that I can sing tearjerkers like George does. Lying on my back, staring at the ceiling, I realized that my opinion of life and relations had made a U-turn. Only 3 months ago, I resented my wife. She wasted all our money on useless luxury things like the devil does, to keep us away from things that really matter. Now I can't wait to spend my share of the money. For over 40 years, I thought women were men's pain in the butt. However, thinking of Emma, my new girlfriend who was going to travel with us to the Caribbean, made me feel happy. I wondered what kind of woman George would accompany him. The only thing he told me was that her name was Nancy, the same as my ex. My friends woke up Saturday around 12 o'clock. By that time, I had already bought a newspaper at the kiosk. I showed George and Michael an article about our shopping street. Again, a criminal dead. We read about another criminal revenge and a shabby chap chained to a bench in the park. He refused to tell the police what had happened. At 1 o'clock that afternoon, two policemen questioned us about our neighbor on the fifth floor. We told the men that we hadn't seen him in ages. The police informed us that the man was in Colombia, so that he indeed couldn't be the killer. That relieved our conscience. The rest of the Saturday, we enjoyed reading our holiday brochures again, and I went to the library to email Emma that she could pack her suitcase as our plane would leave next Monday. George regained his usual spirit and went out to visit his Nancy. Sunday morning after breakfast, only one day away from going to the Caribbean, and not even dressed, we were surprised by someone calling at the front door. The young man introduced himself as Harry Langdon. He showed us his police ID and politely asked if he could rent the fourth room, as we advertised. There are happening so many inexplicable things in this street. The police would like to use your balcony as we can oversee the whole street from here. He reached out for his own binoculars. None of us dared to refuse. So until we would leave the following day, we were saddled up with a young fanatic, but not so clever policeman. Monday morning, 1 hour before the taxi would arrive, the young Harry Langdon still asleep. George asked us for some money to pay our taxi driver and airplane ticket. We decided to put some cash in our hand luggage and leave the rest in the suitcase by the side of the belt. We had promised to meet our girls at the airport, so at about 10 o'clock, we opened the suitcase to take some cash out. But at that same moment, with the suitcase still open on the table, Harry Langdon entered the room in his pajamas. His eyes lit up like glowing UFOs. Michael did not hesitate to explain that he had found the suitcase nearby the man underneath our balcony after he was hit. Though he's not very clever, it took Harry less than a minute to conclude and stammer, This suitcase comes with me, to the police station. He pointed out, like most young people do towards oldies, that we would never be happy with the money we innocently found next to the body of a criminal. It was better for our future to be honest, he preached. We listened to some more of his bad ideas, in which he too believed when we were 25 like him. He ordered us to stay in the room, whilst he got dressed in his private bedroom. At that moment, we were happy that George had found his flamboyant ego again. He shut the trunk as soon as Harry disappeared, took it to his bedroom, and swapped it with the suitcase full of newspapers. 10 minutes later, Harry came back, this time proudly dressed in his uniform. He confiscated the suitcase, told us that he liked us, but added that we were not allowed to leave the building. He promised to be back in the afternoon with some colleagues to question us. The suitcase was almost too heavy for the fragile young man. But anyhow, he managed to leave and celebrate his triumph at the police station. The taxi drove us to the airport. George kept nervously looking back, but we arrived without interruption. George paid the tickets and came back with 5 boarding passes. We sent the suitcase through the luggage control and saw it disappear over the conveyor belt to the Caribbean islands. Then we met the girls. At first, George almost fainted when he saw Emma. He was speechless and unable to explain what happened. Therefore, Emma did, although she was as surprised as George. I discovered I had been chatting and dating George's ex-wife for the last 1.5 months. George recovered. But then it was my turn to almost have a heart attack. An extravagantly dressed lady entered through the hallway in whom I recognized my former ex-wife, Nancy. I tried to hide, but she headed towards us and kissed George, very enthusiastic. "My Nancy," George introduced her. I knew. I had been married to her for 41 years. I still hated her for that, but I must admit that she is a perfect match for George. We got on the plane and arrived at our island without any delay. I arrived as a totally changed person. Life can be sunny.